If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, Syndicate listeners. We've got a jam-packed bonus episode for you today. In episode 5, I interviewed Emily Dufton.
I am a drug historian and writer based in Washington, D.C.
She helped put the Syndicate and Tree's bid to go legal in the context of pot's history in the United States. That included covering the government's moves to outlaw marijuana in the 1930s, the hysteria of reefer madness, and Nixon's 5 schedules of drugs. Well, you won't be surprised to know there's a lot more Dufton had to say that we didn't have time to get to. For instance, you heard that the push for medical marijuana began in the late 80s, but why then? What sparked it? We also skipped over a decade-long decriminalization movement in the 1970s that found surprising traction, then fell apart just as quickly. That's why Dufton titled her book Grassroots, The Rise and Fall and Rise of Marijuana in America. As the drug historian explains, two distinct movements to change laws in favor of pot, one that began in the 70s and one in the 80s, turned out very differently. During my interview, Dufton shared her reasons for that, introduced some colorful protagonists in marijuana lore, and threw in a few little-known anecdotes from weed's roller coaster history. It all provides a better understanding of pot's long road to legalization and why organizations like the Syndicate came to exist. So, let's light this up, shall we? We'll pick up my interview with Dufton right after she tells me that in the 1800s, cannabis used to be available at most corner pharmacies in America.
So you could pretty much go to a corner pharmacy in any populated area and get something for, hey, I have a toothache, I have cramps, I'm feeling nauseous, whatever. And you could get a tincture that generally had at least some cannabis in it, along with all sorts of other fun ingredients. But it was used for a variety of purposes and was considered something that really did have numerous and myriad health benefits.
Mm-hmm. And it wasn't just cannabis, right? There was also, you could get small amounts of cocaine. There were other things that were used for medical treatments. Am I right on that?
Oh, heck yeah. you could get it all. Rather fascinating stuff. And this was, of course, just the stuff that was labeled. But after 1898, you could get small tinctures of heroin, cocaine was available, morphine, you name it. It was pretty much available at the corner pharmacy, really without any kind of prescription or oversight. And then, of course, whatever you were buying from traveling salesmen, like Lord knows what was in snake oil, but you were getting all kinds of fun drugs. So, of course, we somewhat criticize the FDA right now, but it really was kind of the Wild West of medicine, both in the West and the East, prior to the passage of a lot of these government regulations allowing us to know what exactly we were putting into our bodies when we were taking medicine.
Mm-hmm. And when did some of these substances start getting outlawed or at least regulated, and why?
That was in the early 1900s, the early 20th century, through the progressive movement, which was becoming more concerned with the availability of a lot of these substances, because there was a growing acknowledgement that, particularly in terms of morphine and heroin, that they were becoming problematically addictive.
Got it. And then at the same time, you also had some social currents in the United States, especially some social currents against people of color. How much did that play into what would soon happen with the outlawing of cannabis?
Yes, this is the sort of parallel history to the progressive movement, like, hey, maybe we shouldn't sell heroin to kids. It's also right, like, the process of recreational use of marijuana coming to the United States is a slow migration from the South and Southwest as Mexican citizens who were fleeing the dictatorship of Porfirio Diaz started crossing the border and coming into places like Texas and New Mexico and Arizona. And they introduced the idea of smoking cannabis recreationally for the intoxicating effects to the American public. That started making people, white citizens for the most part, freaked out. And that was when state-based laws started being passed that targeted individuals caught with this drug, which were primarily, of course, non-white citizens. And they were starting to target it very excessively. And, you know, that continued on then, had reverberations throughout the rest of the 20th century.
Right. And then what was this concept of reefer madness? It was almost like if you smoked cannabis, then you would become violent and unruly. What were some of the tropes going around at the time?
Yes. Violence, unruly behavior. And one of the bigger fears was miscegenation, which was sexual relations between the races, right? But these ideas were being put forth in the 1930s. It was very famously in a film called Reefer Madness. And of course, this is also tied up into larger stories about the end of prohibition, right? So mm-hmm. What's really important to remember when we talk about Reefer Madness and the rise of Harry Anslinger at the Treasury Department, the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, is that when the United States no longer had alcohol to focus on persecuting and targeting, it needed a new drug. The government needed a new drug, and government officials needed a new drug. So as Harry Anslinger comes onto the job toward the end of federal prohibition, he needs a new substance to target. And, well, there's cannabis.
Got it. So 1 year after Reefer Madness in 1937, Anslinger is instrumental in passing the Marijuana Tax Act. What did that mean for cannabis in the United States?
Well, it essentially meant that it was being taxed. It was not a federal law against it, but it was the first federal law specifically targeting cannabis because it required growers and sellers to file essentially with the federal government and say, yes, I'm doing this. And then they'd have to pay a tax. So the federal government knew who all of the growers and suppliers were.
Sure. It sounds like an act of federal surveillance. And I can imagine if you're a grower, you're kind of looking sideways at these states that are outlawing cannabis outright. And it's like, well, if that happens in my state and I've registered as a tax-paying grower, I am suddenly in the crosshairs or someone that's going to receive immediate scrutiny.
Precisely. This is not going to end well for me. So I'm going to back out now and go back to growing corn or whatever.
So in the 1950s, then, you have cannabis really popularized as kind of this underground culture drug. It's used by a lot of jazz musicians, beat writers. What was its stature at that time?
Yeah, precisely correct. It was this underground, very cool, very hip, very avant-garde substance. But there is this idea that drugs could open the human mind to other realms of cognition and creativity and, you know, consciousness, right? It was very exciting, but very much so known as something used in non-traditional circles, right? And I'm guessing using traditional, not in, you know, sort of outside of like the white cultural mainstream. Yeah, definitely.
Right. But then in the 1960s, that totally changed. Why was that?
Oh, yeah, it totally flipped on its head. You know, the baby boom resulted in one of the largest population explosions in American history. And suddenly, by the mid to late 1960s, these individuals were going to college. So these kids are free, they're on college campuses, they're being exposed to all sorts of new ideas, they no longer have their parents hovering over them. And cannabis migrates away just from those urban centers, but onto college campuses across the United States. And it is one of the fuels for countercultural ideals, which, of course, you know, takes sort of an overwhelming influence over politics and art and culture and music and just about everything else.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Our house is a mess. Come on in. I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wallen.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.
I did want to just touch upon Nixon's Comprehensive Drug Abuse Prevention Control Act.
Yes.
And the Controlled Substances Act, because that's where we get the scheduling.
Yes. So when they're determining the CSA, the Controlled Substances Act, and they're determining the five schedules in which they're going to place drugs, in Schedule 1, drugs are considered to have a high potential for abuse and no medical value, and all the way down to Schedule 5, where drugs are considered to have high medical value and a limited potential for abuse. And Nixon and Mitchell lobbied very, very hard to have marijuana added to Schedule 1 because, again, it was seen as an element and kind of a very clear token of the counterculture, right? Mm-hmm. So how can you target the counterculture, which is like, you know, all of these protesters are in Washington, D.C., on Nixon's front lawn all the time complaining about his policies. Well, how can you target them? I mean, you can't arrest them for protesting, right? That's the First Amendment. You can't do that. But if you outlaw on the federal level the drug that they're using very commonly, well, that's a great way to kind of stick a nail into the counterculture's coffin.
And my understanding, too, is that cannabis was only temporarily supposed to be in Schedule 1.
Precisely. That's how Nixon kind of got his way. He said, well, how about we do this for a process of 2 years or a period of 2 years, and I will get together a panel, a commission, a national commission of 13 people who will study the depth and breadth of cannabis use in the United States, and they will be able to say for sure whether or not it deserves its Schedule 1 placement. Mm-hmm. So the National Commission on Marijuana and Drug Abuse is formed in 1970. It's also known as the Schaefer Commission because its leader, its chairman, was named Raymond Schaefer. And what the Schaefer Commission says is that people who use cannabis are fundamentally really no different from people who don't. They're not more violent. They're not more lazy. They're, you know, functioning individuals, et cetera, et cetera. And they recommend national decriminalization. Mm-hmm. So this comes out in 72. It's widely available. You can buy like a pocket paperback version for $1.25. And Nixon ignores it. He just says like, no, absolutely not. He somewhat misconstrues their findings to the press and says, well, I'll never legalize the drug, which of course was not what the commission was saying. But he kind of tosses it into the trash, ignores it, and keeps marijuana precisely where it is. So that's ultimately why, although the placement was supposed to be temporary, it remains a Schedule 1 drug because Nixon was just like, screw you, Schaefer Commission. I am not going to listen to your recommendations.
But what the Schaefer Commission found seemed to be embraced by increasingly the middle class in the United States, you know, where this is pot joints are being passed around at parties. And then you have an entire rise of cannabis magazines, Cheech and Chong. What was the culture of the 70s like? Because that was when there was some real movement towards decriminalization.
Absolutely. Right. So, as I said, the Schaefer Commission's report was widely available. Anybody could buy a copy at the bookstore. And it really inspired a growing wave of young people who were influenced by the activism of the 1960s. And by the 1970s said, okay, well, it's up to us now to really change laws, not just by protesting and taking to the streets, but by joining state legislatures. So in 1973, starting in Oregon, some young people joined the state legislature. They passed the nation's first decriminalization law, where essentially they put the Schaefer Commission's recommendations into play on the state level. And by 1975 to 1978, there's a wave of 11 more states that decriminalize the personal possession of up to an ounce of the drug. You can have it on you. And now there's all these companies popping up that are making, yeah, bongs, pipes, rolling papers are huge, scales, toys, hiding places, Christmas stockings full of paraphernalia, magazines to support this drug culture, movies, music, everything, you name it. It's like this whole new world of pop culture opens up. And although the United States is going through a pretty fierce recession at the time, by 1977, paraphernalia is pulling in $250 million a year, which is the equivalent today of $1 billion. And there's a stat I found out after I wrote the book, which is a bummer because I should have put that in there. But paraphernalia in 1977 brought in more money than the release of the first Star Wars movie did.
Wow. Take that, George Lucas.
Take that, George Lucas. Take it all the way to the bank.
Well, and then you had Carter's election, and it seemed like for a moment there was going to be potentially national decriminalization. But then that falls apart. What were some of the missteps of that cannabis culture at the time that directly led into what would become the parent movement?
Yeah, there were a lot of kind of fundamental missteps. Decriminalization still allows a lot of products to exist essentially in a gray zone, right? There's not a lot of oversight or regulation. There were bongs that looked like spaceships, Christmas stockings. There was a book called Tots Who Toke, you know, like just not great stuff if you're trying to avoid pissing off parents or government regulators, like bad choices.
Right. And meanwhile, there are also surveys showing that adolescent cannabis use is increasing.
Absolutely. By 1977, 78, 79, rates of adolescent marijuana use are climbing and, in fact, actually sort of peaking, I think, historically, to the point where 1 in 9 high school seniors is using the drug every day, and children as young as 13 report that the drug is very easy to get. And that becomes a very severe problem for the decriminalization movement. Pot is everywhere. As Keith Shuhart, or Marcia Manet, nicknamed Keith Shuhart, don't know why she's nicknamed Keith, but she is. And as she said, you know, it's like the drug followed her home. She was completely unprepared for it. And suddenly her 13-year-old daughter is smoking pot and drinking in her backyard at her 13th birthday party. And what she does is essentially launch a national army of angry parents who take her ideas, spread them nationwide to the point where by 1980, they have their own federal lobbying organization right outside of DC in Maryland. And when Ronald Reagan gets elected president in November of 1980, they are perfectly positioned to deeply influence his administration's execution of its burgeoning war on drugs.
Right. And by this time, their activism and their lobbying have also overturned a lot of the states that had decriminalized pot.
Pretty much all of them.
So Nancy Reagan really embraces this as her cause. And so what effect did she have on burgeoning the power of these parent activist groups?
Yes, Nancy is huge. She is instrumental. I mean, and she's so what we associate with. She's the face of Just Say No today. And, you know, very much so credited with bringing this anti-adolescent drug abuse prevention platform to national consciousness.
And Ronald Reagan uses that to support his Anti-Drug Abuse Act in 1986, which, I mean, really sounds like it just supercharged the war on drugs.
Absolutely. It is probably one of the most important pieces of anti-drug legislation in federal history. And of course, it's being passed in the wave of prominent cocaine-related deaths and in the wake of huge amounts of media freak out about the dangers of crack cocaine. That's where we get the 100-to-1 sentencing discrepancy between crack and powder cocaine. But it passes mandatory minimum sentences for numerous other substances, including cannabis.
Right. And this really, it also leads to even more mass incarceration, which would be important in the social justice argument for legalization that would follow. Could you talk about just how the numbers of incarcerated people just spiked up, and especially disproportionately people of color?
Yeah, so that's the big byproduct of this 100-to-1 sentencing discrepancy between crack and powder cocaine. You know, so you have to have a fairly decent amount of powder cocaine to warrant the minimum sentence, which I think was like 5 years or something. And then you have to have two tiny rocks of crack to warrant that, because it really was believed at the time that the way to win the war on drugs and the way to defeat illicit drug use in the United States was just by incarcerating anyone who was involved in it. And either that would get them clean and they wouldn't go back to it, or they'd be so scared of being incarcerated again that they wouldn't go back to it, et cetera, et cetera. But state laws in a lot of places mirrored these increasing federal penalties. So you have people getting picked up. There's a lot of emphasis on it. There's a lot of benefits for local and state police forces. I mean, police departments got really addicted to this, this constant influx of funds. And it created, it transformed the United States into the country that incarcerates the largest percentage of its population in the world. I mean, we incarcerate more Americans than China does, and China's population is over 1 billion. We're a third of that, and we incarcerate more citizens than China does. It's the effects of this are incredibly negative and long-lasting and incredibly problematic.
The late 80s are such a fraught time. That's also when the AIDS epidemic begins. And this really lays, or is part of what lays the groundwork, at least for medical marijuana. Can you tell me about a person that I was just so fascinated to read about in your book, Brownie Mary Rathbun?
Yes, I love Brownie Mary. She's one of my heroes, and she was one of my absolute favorite people to write about. She's just fascinating. Yeah, so I think one of the coolest things about cannabis history is the way that it overlaps with so many other really intriguing moments in our larger American, you know, historical tapestry, or however you want to describe it. Mm-hmm. And one of those ways is how the medical marijuana movement was entirely sort of interwoven with the AIDS epidemic and the gay rights movement. So Brownie Mary Rathbun was a San Francisco girl. She was quite a bit older, even in the 1980s. She's waitressing at IHOP, and she's been using cannabis every day since she was 35 to deal with the pain in her knees from waitressing every day. And she lives in the Castro District in San Francisco, which was really kind of one of the first gayborhoods in the United States. You know, it's where Harvey Milk had his center, his political center. It's, you know, full of young men. And she becomes friends with a young man named Dennis Perron. He runs a marijuana supermarket, as he calls it, out of his living room in his big group house in San Francisco called the Big Top. And Brownie Mary gets her nickname because she's also a baker, and she makes pot brownies to start being sold at Perron's, you know, marijuana supermarket in his house. Mm-hmm. And they become very popular, and she becomes very popular.
And her name is actually Mary Jane.
Isn't it great? I mean, what a moment of historical kismet that she's actually Mary Jane Rathbun, and it's just, you can't make this stuff up. It's so good. But she gets busted, as you do. And rather than being sent to jail, she's given community service. And she works with an organization called Shanti, which deals with or helps people suffering from terminal illnesses. And in the mid-1980s, these individuals in the Castro District in San Francisco, you know, it's not just cancer, it's what ultimately will be known as HIV/AIDS. No one really understands the disease at this time. It's terrifying, not entirely sure how it spreads. So Brownie Mary starts working with these young men who are dying of these horrible diseases, these myriad symptoms. And she realizes the one thing she can give them to help are her brownies. right? Because mm-hmm. they control nausea. They increase appetite. So it helps with wasting syndrome. They give people a little bit of strength. They give people a little bit of energy. And so she starts baking her brownies again and distributing them just to ultimately who are, you know, HIV AIDS patients. Mm-hmm. And that changes everything. It makes it incredibly sympathetic. So she starts working with Perron to pass legislation that allows providers and doctors to recommend, not prescribe, but recommend the use of marijuana for a variety of different illnesses, including HIV, AIDS, but also cancer, glaucoma, numerous other things. And it results in the passage of the first medical marijuana law in 1996, which was called the Compassionate Use Act, which again has that sense of sympathy and compassion and love and its very title. And, you know, this unleashes a wave of additional legislation to the point where now I think 33 states have medical marijuana laws, with more poised to pass in coming years.
Yeah. And it is amazing just how quickly that happened. You know, going from the Anti-Drug Abuse Act of 1986 to the Compassionate Use Act in 1996.
Yes, absolutely. And it's funny because, you know, you're talking about this shift between 86 and 96. I always sort of see it in like these 10 year phases, right? 76, the parent movement forms, 86, Anti-Drug Abuse Act passes, 96, medical marijuana passes. It's like there's something about the sixes years where things change. But it's absolutely due to a growing recognition of the value the drug could provide for individuals. I mean, you know, everyone knows someone who has cancer. And I think it was also a byproduct of, wow, we passed this incredibly fierce legislation in 1986 against, you know, cannabis, but also lots of other drugs. And the effects were, well, ultimately quite minimal. I mean, the idea of incarcerating individuals for something didn't obviously stop its use. I think that was quite apparent across the United States. And suddenly you had more people knowing someone who had been negatively affected by drug laws than who had been benefited by them. And there was this shift of like, wait a second, this isn't working. And, you know, this drug could help my mom who has, you know, she's going through chemotherapy and she's sick all the time. This could help my grandpa who has glaucoma. This could help my friends. You know, this could help people I know and love. And as soon as that shift occurs, where drug use is seen as sympathetic rather than criminal, laws change always.
Right. And then as soon as you get into recreational, there's also all that tax money suddenly that you can get from selling this stuff.
The story is always about money, isn't it? Yeah. It's like, well, our roads are crumbling, our schools are failing. What can we do? We can sell pot. Of course we can. All of our problems will be solved. And it is fascinating. I mean, the money is a big driver, but I think what's also driving the passage of all these legalization laws is something that, you know, we had discussed a little bit earlier, which is social justice. I mean, when you have very clear statistics saying that, you know, people of color in the United States are incarcerated far more often and far more regularly and for far greater periods of time for the use of this substance than white individuals, whereas people of color and white individuals use pot at pretty much the exact same rates, that's a problem, right? And it also has made state legislatures work a little bit harder to pass these laws. So I think New York is already working on expunging previous marijuana violations from people's criminal records, which is, you know, an incredibly important part of, I think, social justice ideas. Mm-hmm. They're trying to ensure that people who benefit most from what they predict to be will be growing and booming industries are not just like white dudes in suits, the way it often has been in places like California and stuff like that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the corporatization of the cannabis industry.
Precisely, you know, and they're trying to ensure that the tax dollars go to the right places. They're, you know, it is really difficult to take a formerly black market product, make it legal, do it right, and incorporate our growing awareness of the effects of racism on public policy that has been so clearly demonstrated and shown over the past couple of years through you know, public policy papers and scholarship and academic research and all of that. It's, you know, it's a perfect storm of trying to really, I don't know, solve a lot of the nation's problems and counteract a lot of the nation's previous mistakes through laws surrounding just this one little plant. You know, it's a lot to put on poor little pot, you know?
Yeah, well, and there's still so many issues as long as cannabis remains a Schedule I substance at the federal level. I know when you published Grassroots, you had a very strong warning at the end that, you know, don't take any of this for granted. We've seen reversals in the past, you know, with the parent movement. A couple of years later, looking at the current atmosphere in the United States, what are your feelings now about federal either decriminalization or just legalization?
Hard to say. I've never been much of an oracle. I've never been much of a predictor of the future. I'm better at looking at the past, but I remain hesitant to assume that the road to outright legalization and rescheduling the drug will be in any way simple. Mm-hmm. Because, well, I mean, similar to when state-based decriminalization laws in the 1970s were starting to be passed, there wasn't a lot of federal interest because there was so much else going on. And right now, there's a lot happening at the federal level that is really taking legislators' attention away from something like pot. How the federal government functions and if the drug were to be rescheduled is an incredibly convoluted and complicated process that would require congressional approval and the participation of numerous federal agencies, including the DEA, the FDA, Health and Human Services, numerous others, to kind of get on and say, okay, well, if it's not going to be Schedule I, what is it going to be? What does this mean? How do we move it? You know, if all the states are doing this, there's so much work that goes into it. It's not just like you wave a wand and boom, everything's done. It's hard, and this is both the benefit with checks and balances, but also the complication of having this very convoluted form of government that we have.
Right. Well, as you mentioned earlier, I hope you do write a follow-up.
Thanks. Tell that to editors who want to give me very large advances, and I'll do it.
That was drug historian and writer Emily Dufton. You can find out more about her work at her website, emilydufton.com. Thanks for listening to our second bonus episode. For more about this series, visit thesyndicatepodcast.com. The Syndicate is a co-production of Imperative Entertainment and Foxtopus Inc. Executive producer is Jason Hoke. Produced and edited by Laura Krantz and Scott Carney. The Syndicate is scored and mixed by Louis Weeks. I'm your host and creator, Chris Walker. And if you've enjoyed our show, please leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps more people find out about our show.
Mike Carruthers shares little pieces of intel and interviews you can use to improve your life on the Something You Should Know podcast.
The next time you're looking for a job and have to write a cover letter, here's some advice from Skip Freeman, author of a book called Headhunter's Hiring Secrets. Add a P.S. to the bottom of that cover letter. That can actually increase the chances of that letter being read by up to 75%. Some people actually glance down and read the P.S. first.
Something You Should Know. Search on YouTube or wherever you listen.